The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha. So, today I want to talk about a phrase that Master Hua has used. A turn of the head is the other shore. I have been reflecting for many, many months, what are the Buddhist teachings that can help us in the conditions of our present world? With war, with economic hardship, destruction of the environment, with fear and distrust. What are the Buddhist teachings that nourish our own hearts and benefit others? Of course, there are any number of them, but periodically I like to kind of just zero in on one or two. And actually, I find myself a lot of benefit from reflecting on them and then finding a story or two that illustrates how somebody is working with them. So I would like to start with a story told by Ajahn Fanya, who is a senior nun at Chittavaka Buddhist Monastery. And this is from a lecture that was printed in the Forest Sangha newsletter, which is which is their publication. So, in this article, the subtitle of this particular piece is Ominous Men. That Vaisak in Bodh Gaya, I had asked for permission to stay overnight in the temple grounds. The head monk had been very reluctant for me to stay, as earlier in that week, an Englishwoman had been raped and murdered in those grounds. That area of India is very violent, so he didn't think I was safe. I reiterated, I would like to sit under the Bodhi tree, so he finally gave me permission. Then that night, as I was sitting in meditation, there were four Indian men nearby with sticks, big 10-foot-long sticks. Whenever I got up to circumambulate the temple, their sticks would follow, clunk, 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 all four of them. And I would feel waves of fear. Then I would sit down again, and they would all sit down, watching me. It seemed that wherever I went, they would follow and watch me. I spent the whole night having to work with the sense of the ominous presence of these men. Then, about 5 or 6 years later, I was thinking about it. And suddenly, a light went off in my head, and I thought, oh, the head monk probably asked them to make sure I was all right and to protect me. Yeah? And isn't this wonderful? 5 or 6 years later, it dawned on her. And isn't that how we are, really? Because it really takes a long time sometimes for the penny to drop. You know, it just takes as long as it takes. But that's one of my favorite parts of this. And she doesn't say, and what a jerk I was or anything. She just says, you know, oh, finally, I saw it. So the head monk probably asked them to make sure I was all right and protect me. Now, that makes sense, because if I would go to the toilet, they would follow me to the toilet. You know, wherever I went, these men seemed to go. The meaning I had given to them was threatening. The reality was they were probably protective. They didn't look protective, but nobody would have come near me. So wherever we are, as we sit in this place of awakening, it's important to notice what meaning we are giving to this stuff, all that which comes and impacts us. We can give it meanings which in most cases aren't true and often aren't helpful. How different it would have felt if I had sat under the Bodhi tree on that beautiful moonlit night at the center of the universe and thought, ah, four men are here protecting me. What story are we making up and how helpful is it? Keep questioning, how are we framing reality or non-reality, really? Myriad things are happening everywhere. What meaning am I giving to them? The person talking about the political work they're doing and the things that they are witnessing, very terrible things in terms of the kinds of violence that is happening in the world. Yet it becomes a case of what meaning do they give to it? It could be one that makes for a greater feeling of disempowerment and agitation, or one that brings forth compassion and wisdom. So this idea of a turn of the head is the other shore. How is it that we are framing reality? You know, just the kind of slightest shift. Recently, a while back, there were some things of Reverend Master Jiyu's that were offered to the community, and one of them was a kaleidoscope. You know, those old-fashioned kaleidoscopes, okay, with the glass, little bits of glass, and just the slightest shift, and you get an entirely different picture. What a wonderful teaching aid that is. And of course, that's why she had it. These visual images, just tiny, you know, a tiny shift sometimes is all really that we need to do. So Master Hua, whose phrase this is, the turn of the head is the other shore, was the late abbot of the city of 10,000 Buddhas in Ukiah. And their practice is the study of the Avatamsaka scripture. So they are constantly immersed in the big picture. In the big picture. The vastness of the world of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. And this may have something to do with his having coined that phrase, I don't know. But I think of him with immense gratitude for that teaching. So it is pointing to the fact that we can come fresh to each situation and not bring our baggage with us. You know, periodically we can check our bags through. Maybe just have a little carry-on luggage. Pardon me, we just had all these monks depart, so, you know, I was been thinking about we were dealing with all that. But anyway, I mean, it's very interesting, you know, because you know you've got a baggage check. You can always pick it up again later if you want to. But, you know, you've got the option to check it through. So, you know, sometimes it can get pretty heavy. Our meditation points out to us what we are carrying around with us. And sometimes our generous friends do as well. And we hope kindly, but you know, this is how we can get help from our friends, because actually, it's a great kindness when someone points out to us something that we ourselves are not aware of. And, you know, from the Buddhist perspective, this is one of the definitions of friendship. A friend can tell you things that are hard to say. So if it's done kindly, it's a great gift. I got some very wonderful teaching a while back about some luggage that I was carrying around. I was sitting in a doctor's office. I'd taken one of the monks to the doctor, and I was in kind of a gray mood. I was sitting looking for something to read in the doctor's office. I happened to look down, and I saw this magazine with a young man with a shaved head. And I thought, oh, how wonderful, a monk. I'd read a story about a monk. And then I looked at, you know how they have the small print on the cover story. So it turns out he's a surfer. So I have a completely unexamined disinterest in athletes and athletics lifelong. So I thought, no, I don't want to read this, you know, and I put it down. And then I was just sitting there for a minute and I thought, wait a minute, Kodo, there's something kind of funny about that response. You know, it's sort of dismissive. It just, you know, I got that kind of niggle that you get, something's really off. So I thought, now let's just revisit this. So I picked it up again, and I opened up to the cover story inside. So it turns out that this young man is a world champion surfer by the name of Kelly Slater. He is of Syrian descent, and the story is about the fact that he has teamed up with an 86-year-old retired Jewish doctor who himself has been surfing for 75 years. Okay? And they have teamed up to teach surfing to Israeli and Palestinian kids. Because, as they said, kids who grow up surfing together are not going to want to kill one another. And I was so moved by that, the wisdom and, you know, just the beautiful simplicity of that understanding and the compassion and generosity of these two, this young man and this 86-year-old, this fellow of Syrian descent and this Jewish doctor, you know. It was completely encouraging and uplifting, turned my whole day around, okay? A turn of the head is the other shore. So, you know, the question is, what is the baggage that we are bringing to these situations, you know, our prejudices and our preconceived ideas and all of that, that prevent us so often from seeing the treasure that is right in front of us? I wanted to read this very short article that Ordained Master Jisho wrote, back in 94. But it's very much to the point, and it's very succinct. It's called Fine Tuning. The Hubble Space Telescope was sent into orbit to get a clearer view of the universe than can be seen through the Earth's atmosphere. The original pictures sent back to Earth were disappointing because they were out of focus. It was discovered that in the making of the mirrors, a mistake was made. The mirrors were ground incorrectly. The mistake in the grinding of the mirrors was the width of 2 microns. You know, just like that. A micron being 1/50th the width of a human hair. So the error was indeed a microscopic one. A new lens was sent up, installed, and the telescope repaired at an astronomical cost. I was thinking that it was very like that fine tuning that we need to do in order to directly experience the infinite compassion, love, and wisdom that fills the universe. We're stuck out of focus on our greeds, complaints, fears, frustrations, and the trials and vexations of daily life. If we make this very subtle shift in consciousness, about 2 microns over from where we usually perceive the nature of reality, we have access to directly experience the unborn, undying Buddha nature. The shift in consciousness from normal thinking to bringing the back mind to stillness in meditation, letting go of deliberate thought, is the means we have of bringing things into focus. This is explained by Reverend Master Jiyu in translating Great Master Dogen's rules for meditation as neither trying to think nor trying not to think. Just sitting with no deliberate thought is the important aspect of serene reflection meditation. The important changes that we make in our life are subtle ones, bringing things into focus that had previously had been perceived unclearly. This fine-tuning is a constant process of adjusting the focus of our attention, letting go of some worry, dropping an angry thought, letting some fleeting moment of joy go without trying to hold on to it. When we make a small change in our behavior, for example, changing an old habit, being less compulsive about the things we feel we must have or must do, then we change. As we change ourselves, we can see and understand differently. This is far less costly than repairing a satellite and frees us from many karmic burdens. As we continue to meditate and change our behavior, we are afforded a clearer picture of the nature of the universe than we would normally perceive through the atmosphere of worldly thinking. So, something about that article really just resonated with this whole matter. So, bringing this closer to home, focus, you know, when we think about our own training. In spiritual counseling, the dilemma that we may find ourselves with is maybe not what we are doing or not doing, but how we're thinking about it and how we are framing our questions. I find myself frequently, well, wait a minute, is that the right question? Is that really the question? What we can ask ourselves about the question that that is arising about our spiritual dilemmas, we can actually do a little screening for ourselves. If the question sets up the opposites, it's probably not the right one. For instance, should I do this or should I do something else? Can I do this? Can I do that? Should I think about it this way? Should I think about it that way? I keep trying to get so-and-so to see my point of view or understand what I'm trying to say. You know, how can I do that? So, if it's a yes or no kind of thing, or if we think there's only one right answer, we should look again at the question. Because this is one of the teachings that brought me to Buddhism. I grew up thinking there was one right answer, and my job was to find it. And I tried that approach for years until I came to Buddhism. It was one of I feel like it, you know, it was a great gift that I was offered by Reverend Master Jiyu, and she explained it fully. There isn't just one right answer. There are many, many ways to look at things and to do things, and even at that, those things will be constantly changing. Because what is good to do today may not be good to do tomorrow. So it is this incredible kind of spacious situation in which things are, in which there is really a flux. And nothing is set in stone. So to just look at how we are framing our difficulties can really open up some doors for us. A very common theme that people raise is something along the lines of, I keep trying to get rid of my anger. I want to get rid of my ego. I want to get rid of my depression. I want to get rid of my jealousy. And we usually mean forever. That is implied, although it's never spoken, because if we ever said that outright, we'd have to acknowledge what our expectation is. Okay, but that's kind of one of those little things that gets tacked on the end. And, you know, I've talked about this before, but I always keep in mind the teaching that Reverend Master Jiyu gave at a talk in Berkeley at UC when somebody came up to her after the talk and said to her, I really want to give up smoking. I've tried to give up smoking, you know, all my life. I have never been successful. I've tried everything. He said, I don't ever want to have another cigarette. You know, I want to just drop it right now. I want to be done with it. So she looked at him in the eye for a moment or two, and she said, well, can you go the next 5 minutes without having a cigarette? This was the approach. She used to call this shaving the cheese. Okay? You do not pick up one of those big cleavers like we have in the kitchen and hack off a piece of cheese. You get one of those little cheese knives, and it's got a little string on it, and it makes a very, very thin slice. Shaving the cheese is what she would talk about. This is how we work on the koan. So if you are phrasing your dilemma in terms of wanting to give up something for the rest of your life, and you haven't been able to do it, be careful not to then do the other thing that we tend to do, which is hit ourselves over the head because we haven't been able to do that. That is another way of setting up the opposites. So one of the things that we can do in our language, which will help us see how to proceed with this, you've all heard me talk a lot about saying and instead of but in your sentences. Anytime you want to say but, use and. I'm not going to go into that again. You're probably tired of hearing me talk about it. There is another word which is equally powerful, and it is the word with. All right? So instead of thinking about what these things that we want to get rid of, how is it that we can train with them? This is what Reverend Master Jiyu has to say about that. In volume 2 of Roar of the Tigress, Dogen, in his chapter on the deeper meaning of the precepts, is speaking of self-restraint, not of attempting to destroy or defeat evil. Now we have to remember that in Buddhism, when we're talking about evil, we're talking about that which is causes suffering. We're not talking about some inherent evil that exists out there, but actually the clouds that hide us from the eternal, from our Buddha nature. So this is what Reverend Master Jiu says. We attempt to destroy things so as to be rid of them forever, but it doesn't work that way. We need to be able to live with them with self-restraint. This is what I mean when I say the attachments must be rooted out. I do not mean that the attachment shall never rise again. I mean that training is constant, practice is constant, and refraining from all evil is constant. So the with is the important word here. I was talking with someone the other day who gave me permission to share a piece of our conversation because I think it goes to the heart of what we are speaking of here. He spoke of trying to get rid of certain habits of mind and that they kept reappearing. And he found himself locked, you know, in some kind of battle with them. You know, when we do that, the mind keeps trying to find a way out. He was getting very, very impatient with himself and very angry with himself because he was not able to let go of these habits. And he said, then it became very clear to him that he could not abandon himself, that he had to stay present with himself. And that actually becomes our work. We cannot abandon ourselves. We can't turn away from ourselves in anger, in frustration, and just pretending it's not happening. We cannot abandon ourselves. We have to stay present with ourselves. And he said that was the turning point for him. Something shifted and something opened up. And he was able to deal with things that he had not been able to deal with up until then. That is the essence of turning the stream of compassion within. When we do not abandon ourselves, we are turning the stream of compassion within. A turn of the head is the other shore. We hear a lot about wanting to help other people by empowering them to do various things. And I think in our desire to help others, we sometimes overlook the fact that the source of empowerment really lies within each of us. And the power is the recognition of the fact that we actually have a choice at every moment about what we are going to bring to each situation. You know, are we going to approach it with old habits of mind, or are we going to look with fresh eyes? So I would like to end with a religious service that I read in a book called Dreaming Me, an African-American woman's spiritual journey. It's by Jan Willis. I am paraphrasing a bit and omitting a bit. I hope she will forgive me, but there is something here that just leaps out at me. So there is a hymn that is sung, and this is how it goes. He's an on-time God, yes, he is. He's an on-time God, yes, he is. Job said, he may not come when you want him, but he'll be there right on time. He's an on-time God, yes, he is. Then the reverend began to give a sermon, and this is what part of it was. Lots of people nowadays are depressed and despairing. Despondency spreads over the land. There are people right here today who are depressed and despairing, who think that their own individual trials are just too heavy to bear. But he continued, there is a solution for that despair. Count your blessings. How do you count your blessings? Well, you just do it. Every day, in whatever misery, count your blessings. At the end of every day, count your blessings. And then a bit later, he says, what do you need to do in order to hear God's words? The voice of the Lord comes not in a whirlwind, not in an earthquake, not in a fire. It comes in a still, small voice. So in order to hear him, what must you do? You must take yourself aside to a quiet place. Count your blessings. Take yourself apart and wait for God's response. Does that sound similar to Buddhist teaching? You know, the words are a little different. We might say the eternal or the Buddha nature or whatever. But this religious service came from a Sunday service at a Baptist church with an African-American congregation in the Deep South. And it is where the author of this book says, in this Black Baptist sanctuary, I, an African-American Buddhist, had come home.